As the venerable poet Charles Bukowski once said, some people never go crazy. What horrible lives they must lead. Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. Once, my friends, there was a place called the Wooze. There once was a Wooze, there was. It was in the major metropolitan center of Northern California called Vacaville. And yes, that means Cowtown, if you're wondering. And if you were a kid in the 80s and lived on the West Coast, like myself, you might have had the chance to tour the Wooze, a Japanese-style life-size maze filled with tons of other lost children, four towers of overseeing, irritated-looking teenagers, and more hot California sun than you ever knew what to do with. And yes, my friends, in the summer of my 10th birthday, my father and I got lost in the Wooze for what seemed like forever between the brown painted to look more like wood than wood, 7 feet tall walls of this incredible maze. And that day, my friends, I learned two remarkable things. One, I have absolutely no sense of direction. And two, sometimes we just have to find a way to work around our problems. And yes, my father and I did eventually escape the maze, not without tears and the appropriate Slurpee to make my 10-year-old self feel better. And you know, we run into these same issues in our design lives too. Okay, maybe they're shorter than 7-foot walls and maybe they're gray. And yes, maybe if I visit your campus to record a chalk talk or webcast or a podcast, I will probably get lost on the way back from the bathroom. But today we are talking about getting around some of the tough issues in our embedded computing designs. How do we keep our embedded software safe from point A to point B to C and maybe over to D too? Today, my guest is Nigel Forrester from Concurrent Technologies, and we're talking about the balance between the legacy things we have to do and the futuristic stuff we want to do, and how we weave our way through this complicated product life cycle maze. All right, let's go. Thank you so much for joining me, Nigel.
Thanks for having me, Amelia. Great to see you again.
Okay, so your presentation at the Embedded Tech Trends conference this year was called Back to the Future. Now, other than the awesome graphics from the movie of the same name, you spoke a lot about balancing the legacy things we have to do with the futuristic stuff we want to do. Now, give me an example of what you mean by this. And some of this has to do with life cycle, yeah?
That's right, Amelia. I mean, we make all sorts of different processor boards based on Intel devices, and we have many, many customers who need backwards compatibility. And on the other hand, we also have key requirements to meet new features, particularly things like security requirements. And it's trying to get that balance between the legacy, the history, the backwards compatibility, and at the same time with some of these new things which are sort of mutually incompatible. So we have to sort of do the impossible in some ways to make those work together. And that's really what I was talking about.
Okay, now I've heard similar stories as you presented today. We have to run the same application code we developed years ago. We can't change the OS. We don't want to change suppliers. We need security. We got to run for a couple more decades. But your Intel processors can help with some of these issues, right?
That's right. So one of the areas that we've got really good scope these days is with the Intel embedded processor range, now available for 15 years lifecycle from Intel. And the sort of core capability of those processors is that they use what's called a UEFI BIOS to boot the device. They've moved to that because it's more secure and it also simplifies the solution. However, one of the capabilities of UEFI BIOS is it requires a 64-bit operating system. So that means that you can't now boot your 32-bit operating system. Is that Windows 7, Linux 32-bit, VxWorks, 6.x, whatever. So one of the areas that we can get around that is that if you boot using a hypervisor, and that might be a hosted or a bare metal hypervisor, you can then run your legacy operating system and application on one of the latest Intel processor boards that we do in a virtual machine. So effectively, you can still got that complete backwards compatibility. You can still run exactly the same application that you ran 20 years ago, but you're actually booting it and running it on a hypervisor. And the performance overhead is very small, you know, between, depending if it's a bare metal hypervisor, perhaps 1-3%. If it's a hosted hypervisor, maybe up to 10%. But the modern processors are so high performance that, you know, actually you've probably got a much higher solution overall as well. So that's one good way of trying to square the circle with the sort of legacy and the current generation products that we have.
Okay, so there are some new restrictions with these Intel processors that can cause some problems as well.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about with this UEFI BIOS. So that's been around now for probably 10 years, the concept of UEFI BIOS. It's become only more relevant with recent devices because the latest processors from Intel, and in fact they've announced that all Intel processors from 2020 will only be bootable with the full UEFI Class 3 BIOS. So you can't have what was called the legacy BIOS or compatibility support module anymore. We're actually now shipping products that are UEFI only, which, as I said before, gives you the benefit of much better security. But it does then mean that there is no way to natively boot these legacy operating systems. So that's, you know, it's just modern progression, really, that gives you better capability, but you've got to find a way around it.
Okay, let's talk about those security capabilities that are being constantly asked for these days. What are you seeing specifically in this space? And you have to look at the bigger picture, right?
Yeah, so as a board manufacturer, we design and then we manufacture the products in our factory in Colchester in the UK. And the sort of customers that we're dealing with are, obviously, security is one of their top concerns. And they like to think of need end-to-end security. When we manufacture the boards, we load trusted firmware onto the products. And we ship the boards to our customers. And once they get to the customer, they're in a completely trusted environment. However, one of the potential gaps is in transit between our factory, when it leaves us in a trusted state, and when it arrives at our customer. And we've had many people in the last couple of years start to worry about, well, could that product be intercepted? Could the firmware be changed? Because if so, we'd never know. You know, we'd just assume it was from Concurrent Technologies and we wouldn't know the wiser. Sure. And we've done things like put anti-tamper labels on boxes. But the reality is, you know, it's quite easy to replace a label if you have to.
Sure.
So we've gone one stage much further now, and we've implemented what's called Intel Boot Guard. And what that means is when we actually create the firmware on our in our factory, we sign that with a private key. And then at the last stage of manufacturing, when we load the firmware onto the board, we actually fuse that firmware using a public key. So it is locked to that specific board type. And so if anybody does intercept the product, either in transit or any other time during the life cycle of the product, and they try to change the firmware, the board won't boot. So it effectively guarantees that if you buy a Concurrent Technologies processor board, and it's one of our latest boards implementing Boot Guard, we can make sure that that is running the authorized correct firmware, which is closes another security gap.
Absolutely. All right, Nigel, now it's time for your off-the-cuff question now. And we've talked about the past in previous episodes of Fish Fry, but you want to talk about the future, or at least the present, and why the present is quite amazing. Tell me more.
Well, yes, I was, as you rightly said, talked a lot about the past in these things. and I was sort of being a little bit more philosophical recently, and I was just amazed by how fast technology's moved on, you know, since I've been in the industry. What wonderful gadgets we have these days. We all carry around these incredible smartphones that, you know, you do amazing all sorts of things. We drive autonomous or semi-autonomous vehicles, if you're lucky enough to own one of them. We have access to the most amazing, you know, gizmos and gadgets. I just think it's an incredible time to, you know, we're sort of living in the future in some ways. But then again, maybe I should revisit this question in another 5 or 10 years, because I'll probably think, well, actually, that was the Stone Age. look how lucky we are now. But it's good to be part of that era, I guess.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. Well, Nigel, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me yet again.
Thank you, Amelia. Look forward to seeing you again soon. Bye-bye.
From getting lost in a Japanese-style maze, to getting lost in our own product lifecycle management, to a speck of wayward stardust getting lost on planet Earth. This week's news you may have missed is all about that grain of dust. Now, we all know that our sun is around 4.6 billion years old, right? And that means that it's pretty much a youngster in the history of our galaxy. Stars were born, lived, and died before our big old ball of incandescent gas came along. And most of the time, proof of those stars are hard to come by. Until recently, that is. Researchers at the University of Arizona have discovered a tiny, tiny grain of stardust stuck in a primitive, non-metallic meteorite found in Antarctica that predates our sun and challenges some of our prevalent theories about how dying stars seeded the universe with raw materials and how those raw materials formed planets and ultimately the molecules of life. Okay, so what exactly did they find? This team from the University of Arizona, using ion and electron microscopes, examined this tiny speck of stardust down to its atomic level. And not only did they find that this speck, called LAP-149, was mostly made of graphite, but that it also had extremely high levels of a carbon isotope called 13C. Now, that isotope came from a nova. Crazy, right? And folks, it gets better. So until LAP-149, the carbon isotopic compositions discovered just about anywhere in our solar system normally varied from a factor on the order of 50. But the carbon isotope found in LAP-149 was enriched to more than 50,000-fold. And on top of that, further analysis showed that there was also a high oxygen silicate impurity embedded deep inside LAP-149 that has never been found in a grain like this before. The ramifications of these two discoveries is put quite well by Pierre Hanecourt, one of the lead researchers on this project. He says, "These results provide further laboratory evidence that both carbon and oxygen-rich grains from novae contributed to the building blocks of our solar system." Okay, so at some point, billions of years ago, at least, say, 4.7 billion years ago, probably longer, that tiny grain of graphite called LAP-149 escaped a stellar explosion called a nova. Then not only did it survive the journey through interstellar space, but it also traveled on over to what would become our solar system, where it became embedded in a primitive meteorite, which eventually landed on Earth. Wow. There is so much more cool stuff about this announcement. So if you want even further information about the University of Arizona's study of LAP-149, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. And by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you everyone for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, I will see you at the Design Automation Conference in June, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city. I love that stuff. Shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of May 3rd, 2019, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.